and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And I think that Betty, I call her up to introduce our speaker tonight.
Hi, I'm Betty, an alcoholic, and that's totally irrelevant. The point is that we're having a speaker tonight who's a young lady who has completely dedicated herself to this program, completely given herself to this simple program, and she has the capacity to be honest. And that is, those are the key things, the willingness and the honesty. And it's impressive. She doesn't drink. She goes to meetings. She participates in meetings. She has a sponsor who has a sponsor. She sponsors people. She gives to the basket. All the good stuff. She's also a little bit nervous, so I want to make, I want you to promise. I guarantee her she's among friends tonight, so please laugh at all the right places.
Karen?
Hello. My name is Karen, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January the 25th, 2011. My home group is Skyland Group, which meets on Tuesdays and Fridays at 8. Beginners meeting at 7 on Fridays. And my sponsor, who just introduced me so graciously, is Betty B. I was told from the beginning that if I don't have a sponsor, I'm sponsoring myself. If I don't have a home group, I'm homeless. And if I don't have a sobriety date, I'm drunk. So those things are all really important. I'm going to do what's conventional and tell you in a general way what it was like for me growing up through the years, what happened, the changes that happened, and what it's like today. So, and yes, I am a little bit nervous, so bear with me. Okay. I was born an uh-oh baby. I was born as a last attempt to save a marriage, as I was told later by my mother. they were in a failing marriage, and it was already going awry before I came around. But I was born during a tropical storm in the late 70s. I'm not going to tell you exactly when. And my father was out of town on business, and my mother's friend had to take her to the hospital, and they almost died twice because the rain was so torrential, and they got there to the hospital, and she said that the doctor that was on duty, one of the doctors, was drunk, and he heard two heartbeats, and he said she was having twins, and she's like, what? And all these things were happening, and also, on top of it all, I was born at the very last minute. I was running out of oxygen really quickly, and I was an emergency C-section baby, so I almost didn't live. So, I was kind of born into tragedy. We lived in Little Creek, Virginia. I was a Navy brat. My dad was an officer in the Navy, went to the Naval Academy, and got his engineering degree at RPI in Troy, New York. And when he was promoted to captain of the Navy, we moved to Philadelphia. I was probably about 3 at that time. I remember 3 things about Philadelphia. I remember digging big tunnels in the snow, because they had really big snowstorms and we had a really big backyard. I remember when the Delaware River flooded and crested during a really bad rainstorm and came up to our front steps, and my mom freaked out and took me and the dogs upstairs and was like, the house is going to get swept away. And I remember constantly having stomach aches because my parents were always fighting. I don't remember my dad being around much. I just don't have a lot of memories of him because he was never there. He traveled a lot on business, and I think he tried to stay away. Like I said, the marriage was no good by the time I entered the scene. And my first drunk, at least to that, I don't remember it. It has to be told to me, and it's told to me by my mother, and she thinks it's really funny because I was about 3 or 4 years old, and my parents were always throwing these really extravagant dinner parties, being a high-ranking naval captain. after having dignitaries over, fancy dinner parties and all that stuff, and I had a nanny, and my nanny had put me to bed. I guess they assumed I was asleep, but something woke me up, and I came downstairs, and one of the guests at some point was like, look at that little girl, because I was going around and drinking after all the cups that were left, like taking sips of liqueur or wine or God knows what, and my mom said that was the first and only cabaret performance she's ever seen of a little girl get on the sofa and sing Mary Had a Little Lamb. So that was my first drunk, and I don't remember it, but my mom thinks it's kind of funny, but it's definitely foreshadowing as what was to come later. So like I said, my dad was barely around. By age 5, they officially divorced. My mom and I packed up the car we had and a dog. By then, we had one dog. The other dog died. And we were going to move to Wilmington, North Carolina, or Biloxi, Mississippi, because she had good friends in both places. And she said by the time she got to Wilmington, she was too tired of driving, so that's where we stopped. And we basically went from riches to rags. I didn't know this at the time. My mother was very savvy with money, but we were definitely eligible for welfare and food stamps and stuff for a while, but my mom was too proud for that, and she just worked really hard. And I remember her working a lot, and I stayed with the neighbors a lot until she finally was able to save up enough money to buy a house, you know. She's just really good with money, and she did that, and my father's child support check started coming in, so that probably helped too. So, growing up in Wilmington, North Carolina, let's see, I was an only child. I always felt this feeling, just loneliness a lot. I was alone a lot. My mom would say, go play in the backyard and, you know, fence in the backyard and whatnot. But, you know, I just remember being alone a lot and feeling lonely a lot. And I had lots of imaginary friends and all that weird stuff that only children do. But I just remember feeling alone a lot. And something happened to me by the time I was 8 that should not happen to anybody under the age of 18. And I was threatened by those boys to never tell anyone, and I didn't. I kept that secret. But what that caused in me was a deep sense of shame. Anytime anybody said I was pretty, I felt ashamed and I felt dirty. And anytime anybody gave me a compliment, I would just put my head down, and sometimes I'd start crying. But I never told. So I was scared they're going to hurt my mom like they told me they would. And nothing ever became of it. I never told even later, you know. I can't even remember their names now. But, you know, I was really confused by that whole situation because I knew that it was wrong, but it happened to me, you know, so did that make me a bad person? I kind of thought that it did. Fast forward a few years, my mother met a well-to-do man. By the way, I asked for a baby brother or baby sister every year for Christmas, and I usually got gerbils or cats or dogs. So I guess no more kids for Ma. But she did meet and marry a well-to-do man from a good local family in Wilmington. And I suddenly had a stepdad and a step-grandmother and grandfather, and my grandmother doted on me, and she called me her little porcelain doll, and she put me in modeling classes, and we'd go on shopping trips, and we did all these little things and together, and like she adored me because I was the only child in her life, and when she told me I was pretty, I believed her. You know, she told me I was pretty, like, because I trusted her, you know. I didn't feel ashamed when she said that. So we basically went from being kind of, you know, paycheck to paycheck to marrying into this well-to-do family. And before long, by the middle of sixth grade, so that's middle school, my parents built a house, and they built it out in the kind of ritzy suburbs by this golf course on the outskirts of Wilmington. And that was really traumatic for a kid to go from knowing everybody from kindergarten to middle of sixth grade to knowing nobody, and that's what happened. And all my shyness and I think some of that shame and just all kinds of stuff just kicked in, and like I was just like this weird quiet kid, and I hated it and was really depressed, you know. And I know they say your preteen and teenage years are full of angst and rage, but for me it was really serious. I actually remember stealing like a bottle of some weird vitamins my mom had, and I put them in my backpack, and I told myself, I'm going to take all these vitamins today so I don't have to wake up. And my mom found them, and she was good at not dealing with stuff, so she just scolded me and said that was really stupid and not to do that ever again. So I didn't. So here I am, and probably by now going into seventh grade, and I was used to running around with a group of people, with friends, my friends, and I didn't have any friends really. So I started hanging out with the bad kids because they were nice to me, and because I had money to do with my stepdad, and I would buy them really nice Christmas and birthday presents, and they kind of befriended me. So I was like this weird kid that was in all the honors classes, but I was skipping school and smoking cigarettes, and by this time starting to drink, starting to take put liquor in the thermos bottles and whatnot, and I'd take it to school, and some of these kids were starting to have sex, and I wasn't quite ready for that. But yeah, I was hanging with the bad kids, and I was living the Jekyll and Hyde lifestyle already by seventh grade, and that continued through high school. And I graduated, and I did go to college. But of course, those behaviors just continued because there was nothing there to interfere with that. I'll back up a little bit. I started definitely going to late punk rock shows by age 14. Started dyeing my hair. My mom and I fought constantly. She hated what I was doing to myself. And let me back up a little bit. When I was halfway through my senior year, I came home one day, and half of the stuff had been moved out of the house. And my mom and stepdad had gotten a divorce, and I had no idea because I was so self-absorbed. And my mother was really drunk. I don't think she's an alcoholic. I think she just drinks from time to time. And she was screaming at me and telling me it was all my fault, and if I didn't dye my hair purple and stay out till all night, hours of the night and run around these bad kids, that this wouldn't have happened. So I was basically like, well, you know what? I'm just going to keep doing that because that's just what I want to do, and you're really pissing me off right now. So I did. I continued that lifestyle, and I did it because I felt accepted there. You know, I felt accepted amongst the misfits and the skater kids and the burnouts and the bleacher preachers, like we call them, the ones that went under the bleachers and did all kinds of stuff. And you know, the popular kids by then had left me alone. I was in their classes, but they were like, okay, she's definitely not one of us. But they didn't pick on me anymore because I had a crew to run with. And so that behavior continued through college. I picked Appalachian State because it was far away from my mother as possible. And I immediately fell in with the college kids up there, and started drinking and smoking and doing all lots of other stuff. Got into the rave scene pretty big. And I remember I came home for Christmas, and I had gotten a .8 GPA. Yes, that's actually possible. I got put on academic probation. And, you know, but I did graduate, barely. And the only reason I got a job was because I had procured a summer internship with this really good company in Wilmington. So that job was offered to me after school, and I took it. And now I was, you know, I had arrived. You know, I had my own paychecks coming in. I was like, I'm not going to live with my mother. I'm going to live downtown, stumbling distance from all the bars. I picked up with my old punk rock friends again, you know, and my drinking just escalated. You know, it got worse and worse. I became a daily drinker. I had to drink every day, or I would feel the physical effects. Needless to say, I lost that job due to excessive absences and unexplained absences for like weeks at a time. And let's see. So I started just crashing with these friends because, hey, I had this crew of friends that loved me no matter what, right? You know, and I was a chemistry major. I decided to major in chemistry because one of my friends in Boone had mafia connections and said that I could go into chemical manufacturing after I graduated. So I was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. But it, actually, that fell through. But I did get a chemistry degree. That's kind of how I got into it. That's kind of funny. But So I'm in Wilmington. I'm jobless and homeless. I'm couch surfing definitely for a while until my so-called best friends, you know, got real sick of me real quick. And I'm going to visit my mom one day, and she didn't recognize me when she opened the door. I'd shaved my head. She said I looked like a late stage cancer patient. I remember walking through the house and looking at pictures of her and I when I was little. I didn't recognize myself, and something inside me told me this had to stop. And I don't know where it came from, but I said, I think I need help. And she checked me into a rehab and went the next day. But as in every other time, anytime I went into a new situation, I sought out the people in rehab that were sneaking in the good stuff, and I didn't learn anything. And as soon as I got out of rehab, I got drunk, so that didn't work too well. That continued on for a while. Let's see. I started dating the son of a really high-ranking official at UNCW and got into grad school that way. I basically slept my way into grad school. And, my first semester, however, because I was continuing with that lifestyle, I almost flunked out. And again, I had another, what I like to call a bottom. And the best definition I've ever heard of a bottom is when the spirit refuses to go on any further, and the moment of clarity is reached. And I was like, I'm not going to get through grad school, and I really want to do this, you know. So over Christmas break, I went to like a kind of a quick rehab, and I got sober. And it's the first time I actually stayed in AA for a little bit. But I didn't do a damn thing. I didn't work any steps. Barely, I should say, work steps. I'm going to say I didn't. I had a sponsor who I ended up living with, she kind of just co-signed a lot of my stuff. She did her best, but, you know, I kind of felt my heart. I was just trying to fake it till I make it, like they say sometimes, you know, but I just couldn't quite fake it fast enough, because after I graduated grad school, and I did well with that, but not too long after, I got drunk. Because I didn't follow directions, I didn't surrender myself to this program. And a couple of years of this, I felt pain and loneliness like I never felt before. They say a belly full of booze does not mix well with a mind full of AA, and that's really true. And I felt that. So after losing yet another job due to excessive absences and whatnot, I hit another bottom, and again, I just couldn't go on anymore, and I seriously considered suicide, because I was like, what's wrong with me? Why can't I get my life together? You know, everyone around me is, and, but I did. I got sober, and I hit a bottom. I went to, like, just a quick detox, I think, at that time, and I got sober, and I fell in love. I fell in love like I'd never fallen in love before, and he had a little bit more time than me, and we managed to put together almost 2 years sobriety. He was like a half a year ahead of me, and he proposed to me, and everything looked so beautiful, and he was just made me laugh, and he was awesome. And he had a job offer in northern New Jersey, which was away from everything that I knew, and he proposed to me and said, will you move up there with me? And I said, yes, of course, I'll leave everything behind and move up there with you, because I'm in love. And you know, I did that for love. And we were both sober when we got up there, but we did not stay sober. And we did not stay sober because we didn't plug in. That's what happens to alcoholics, trust me. We didn't go to meetings. We just stayed dry for a while, and then eventually on a client dinner, I remember he ordered a Jack and Coke. I ordered a Jack and Coke, and like a few years later, I was basically proverbially banging my hand on the bar going, what the hell happened? You know, it was pain and misery beyond what I had ever known to be. He was not physically, but he was verbally and emotionally abusive when he was drunk. We had horrible fights. We got evicted because of that. And it was really, really awful those first 3 years up there, right outside New York City, one of the greatest cities in the world. Financial problems started to happen. He lost that great job, so I was supporting him with my job. And it was really, really freaking sad. So I'm just going to stop right there because basically he, on that part, because he got a job offer, and this is God working in my life. I see it now. I got a job offer 6 states away, assuming I was going to go with him, and I was like, no, I'm not, because I'd been wanting to get sober for a long time, and I knew we were just killing each other. And so he left, and I stayed, and I moved to Hoboken, the next town over from Weehawken, New Jersey, right outside New York, and got sober within a week after him leaving. And stayed sober for a while there. You know, stayed sober a few months, got a sponsor, started to do what I was supposed to do. But again, boy meets a girl on AA campus, and I fell in love. I fell in love again, and I fell in love really, really hard. And this guy beat the other guy by all means. I mean, like, seriously, like, we were soulmates. Like, he knew what I was feeling, what I was thinking. Like, we had this psychic connection. Like, it was almost like freaky, and it was really beautiful. And he was sober like about a year more than me, and things were really beautiful. And we dated for about 6 months, so at about 9 months sober, one day, I didn't hear from him, and we always texted and called each other every single day. And someone told me to drive down to his house, and I did, and the door was locked, and we kicked the door down, and he was lifeless on his bed. He had gone out that night, he had relapsed, not told anybody. He didn't tell me, he didn't tell anybody, he didn't tell his best friend he was living with. And that devastated me, and I didn't stay sober through it. I wish I had, but I didn't. You know, I knew I should have, but I just, at that point, I was so mad at God, you know, that, I didn't. But the women that surrounded me that I'd met through Hoboken and AA were amazing and incredible, and that's where I felt God. And one night, I actually had this experience, and I feel like it was my first true spiritual experience, and he spoke to me in a dream, you know, and he told me that he loved me, and he told me that he's going to look out for me, and he told me to get sober, you know, in that dream. And it was really vivid, and I woke up and I could almost smell him and feel him. It was really intense, and I got sober that day. It was January 25th, 2011, and I haven't drank since. During that time, right around that time, we had discussed moving back south because my mom's getting older, and I knew that I needed to try to come back down this way. She lives in North Carolina, still in Wilmington, and had a really good job offer here in Atlanta. And I decided to go ahead and take it. So I moved to Atlanta with less than a month sober, grieving the death of the love of my life. And that's not a really good combo. I showed up at meetings here. I was a wreck. I couldn't open my mouth without crying, but I kept coming because, like, I knew I had to stay sober. Like, I knew I didn't have another. They say you always have another drunk left in you, but not necessarily another sobriety. Like, I know I don't even have another drunk left in me. You know what I mean? Like, if I take a drink again, I just know I'm gonna die. Like, I know it. And so that was, I moved here mid-February of last year, and I plugged right in. You know, I started going to meetings every day, started reaching out to people, and it was really hard. It's Atlanta's a tough town to get sober, or at least from my perception, which was very skewed, I believe. From where I was at, I still felt alone. However, there were a few shining beacons in my life, and some of them are here right now. And, you know, they were amazing, really early sobriety. And I met a kick-ass sponsor who took me through all 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, took me through the beginning of the big book, taught me the importance of service work, and met with me regularly. I had to call her every day. And she was amazing. You know, she's an amazing sponsor. I start sponsoring by, this was like by the holidays, and none of my girls stayed sober, and I was so frustrated. I was like, why can't you get it? But like, come on, you know, just look at myself. Like, I know why you can't get it, because it's freaking hard, you know? And holidays came and went, and we actually ended up parting ways, and I think we kind of outgrew each other, and that happens sometimes with sponsors, which is what led me to Betty, and she's my sponsor now. And I sponsor one woman right now, Laura, and I want to talk about my second spiritual experience. These are really important to me because, if you haven't noticed, I never talked about going to church, and I never talked about God being in my life, and I've always struggled with that, and I've tried to fake it till I make it with that one, but I didn't get it, and I almost thought it was just like, you know, when I would get on my knees and pray like I was told to do, it felt mechanical, and it felt just fake, and it was like, this isn't real, you know, except for those spiritual experiences, except for that first one and the second one I'm about to tell you about. I got a phone call on March the 11th. It was a Sunday. I might have the date wrong, but it was a Sunday. And it was my sister. She's my half-sister. And she said that my dad's on his deathbed. And she just wanted to let me know. And I heard this really clear voice that told me that I had to go and see him. Like, it was so clear. And I was awake. It wasn't in a dream. And so I got online right away and started looking for flight information, called my sister and said, I'm coming. I called his by then sixth wife and said, I'm coming. And and she was a little hesitant at first, and I was like, you know, I'm his daughter, and I know I haven't been in his life, but I'm coming. So, you know, basically do what you want with that one, but I'm coming. And I did, and I showed up, and my sister picked me up at the airport, and she took me directly to the hospice center where he was. And I walked in, and my dad was 73, but he looked like he was about 103, because he was just like us. He was an alcoholic. However, he never found the rooms of AA, and he was dying of cirrhosis of the liver and other multiple organ shutdowns. And he looked awful. He looked like he was 110 years old or more. And I immediately started crying when I saw him, and my sister said, you know, she was right there. She was like, I'll give you some time alone with him. Why don't you just sit with him? And I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And she sat on one side, and I sat on the other, and she held his hand, and I held the other hand. And she was just like, just talk to him. She's like, do you believe that he can hear you? And I was like, yeah, I do. Because actually, somewhere a while back, when I was in grad school, I started volunteering for hospice, and because I wanted to go to med school, which I'm glad I didn't, because I would have flunked out. But I believe that they can hear you, even if they're, you know, really almost a comatose, even if they are. And he was definitely, you know, very heavily sedated and whatnot. And so she sat there, she held one hand, and she was like, hey, Dad, it's me, Wendy, your daughter, I love you, blah, 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 blah. And she's like, I'm going to give you some time alone with him. And I said, okay, okay. And she left the room, and it felt kind of weird at first, but as soon as I grabbed his hand, I started rubbing his head. And as soon as I started doing that, my heart filled with this love and this empathy that I've never, ever felt before for another person. I knew exactly why he never tried to reach out to me, because he was a severe alcoholic, and it's all he could do to just have this stellar career. He didn't know how to maintain relationships with his children, and I know that he wanted to, and I felt that in my heart on that day. And I believe that there were three people and entities in that room. That it was me, him, and God. And I was holding his hand, and I was stroking his hair, and I said, Dad, I love you, and I just want you to know that we're all good, and I forgive you, and I'm sorry I wasn't a better daughter to you. And he squeezed my hand, and he mouthed the words, and that's all he could do. And then he just kind of went back to his little kind of weird kind of bobbling around a little bit. But, you know, he did that. And I knew right then that we were good. And I still feel that in my heart, you know. I mean, it was pretty recent, but that was real strong stuff. And I was able to make it. I was able to show up for the funeral. And that was, you know, he died 2 days later, by the way. And I showed up for the funeral, and I showed up with as much grace and dignity as I could, despite my wicked sixth wife stepmother and older sister who's a raging alcoholic and came stumbling in and kind of made a fool of herself and all that stuff. I was very kind to all of them, and because, you know, I kind of took pity on them too. And I'm an angry, angry bitch, and I don't know where all this pity and empathy's coming from, let me just say right now, but it's got to be something greater than me, you know? And I'm just now starting to develop that relationship with God, and God showed me those experiences, and I'm sure if I go and look back at, I'll see God more and more that was there in my life, and I just didn't even notice it, because I was too drunk or whatever to pay attention, but, my life today is, you know, it's, I compared it to when I first came in, it was like a roller coaster. It was definitely up and down and up and down. It was thrilling, it was exciting, and it was terrifying, and it was wonderful. And now it's kind of like a lazy river. It just kind of like goes around, and like occasionally get a little eddy, and then, like, you know, just it's a lot more laid back. But it's a good ride still. It's a lot more tranquil. I can sit with myself alone in a room and be completely content with that and not have to feel the need to call somebody. I can pray, I can sit quietly. I can pray for people that I don't like. I can pray for people I can't stand today. That's a miracle. This program has many gifts, and I've only been sober not quite 15 months, but I can't wait to see what the next 15 months and then some have in store, you know, because for me, this is for life. I don't have another drunk left in me, and I definitely don't have another sobriety left in me, so this is it. And I want to conclude with this passage in the big book that's been giving me a lot of hope, and I think it just sums up all the promises and all that stuff, and it's out of working with others. It's on page 100. It says you and the new man, but I'm just going to say you, so just bear with me. You must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. And I believe that paragraph today, like, with all my heart, as cheesy as that might sound, because I've seen it, I've seen God work in my life, you know, and I'm far from perfect. I have a temper, I get angry, I do really stupid shit, but you know, I do my best, and as long as I do a few simple things, like Betty said, you know, keep a sponsor, make meetings, reach out to the newcomer, because then if they felt anywhere as near as petrified as I did, I gotta reach my hand out and get their number and freaking call them, you know. That's one of the hardest things to do, is call someone you just met and you're coming to this program, you know, in my opinion. This is just what I do. I mean, everybody does stuff different, but and I pray every day. I ask God to keep me sober every day, and I thank Him every night, and I pray for all the people that I don't like every night, and the people that I do care about every night. And the list is getting longer and longer. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's pretty much where I'm at today. So thank you for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope.
And I've lost some day and night. I need someone's hand, carry me when I'm tired. I got to go, I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway.
On that broad highway.